The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Bite.
Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources. Or check out all the original writing on our website at subchina.com. We've got reported stories, essays and editorials, great explainers and trackers, regular columns, and of course, a growing library of podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim people in China's Xinjiang region to the tectonic shifts underway as China rolls out what we call the Red New Deal. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. There is a growing body of literature that explores the relationship between psychology and politics, and that's something that's been a topic of considerable interest to me of late. If you're in the U.S., there is a good chance you've come across some of these studies, as quite a few of them have received, you know, a decent amount of media attention. So you might have heard about, for example, studies that look at traits like the disgust reaction and how that seems to be positively correlated with political conservatism. Here in the U.S., we've been wrestling domestically with the specter of authoritarianism. Not surprisingly, there's been a slew of papers looking at personality traits, you know, some of which may actually have genetic components to them that predispose certain people toward acceptance of or even a preference for authoritarian leaders or political styles. But frustratingly, I haven't seen a whole lot of this applied to China. So when I came across a still unpublished paper a couple months ago by Rory Truex, a scholar at Princeton I esteem, when I came across this paper that looked at potential associations between certain personality traits and political discontent in China, I was naturally intrigued. It's a great paper once you get your head around all the methodology and the statistics and such. And if you do go to rorytruex.com, you'll see it there among his recent papers. It's called Political Discontent in China is Associated with Isolating Personality Traits. With the holidays now behind us, we were finally able to schedule some time to really dig into the paper, which, again, I found really fascinating. Rory is Assistant Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton, and listeners to the show may remember him from a show that we did about a paper he and Sheena Greitens co-authored, where they looked at whether China scholars are engaging in self-censorship. Nason Makhboubi joined us on that show. Rory, man, it's been too long. Welcome back to Cynica at last.
It has been a long time, and I remember seeing you in Chapel Hill, and I think we got barbecue back in the before times, and so hopefully that can happen again someday.
Yeah, the before times, prelapsarian ages. I'll barbecue is on the menu. So, Rory, this paper is another contribution to an increasingly rich catalog of papers and monographs that look at authoritarian resilience in China, right? Not too long ago, I had Manfred Elfstrom on the show, the University of British Columbia. We were talking about his book on workers and protest in China, another book that I think, it falls very, very much in that category. And as we were chatting, I just kind of rattled off
The names of quite a number of guests that I've had on the show are people, you know, who I, you know, have been in dialogue with, who've written about one aspect of this topic or another. It strikes me that authoritarian resilience is something of an obsession for younger American political scientists. I am not exaggerating when I estimate that half of the assistant and associate professors that I know who work on China and now teach in political science departments do at least some of their work, perhaps even the lion's share of their work, the best known work on some facet of authoritarian resilience. So I mean, there's you, Rory, there's Manfred, there's Sheena, who we've mentioned, Maria Repnikova, Christian Sirace, Dan Mattingly, Molly Roberts, Jennifer Pan. I mean, these are just off the top of my head, so I'm sure I could come up with many more. My question is, what's up with that, Rory?
Well, that's a good question. And now that you say all those names, it does seem to be something of a trend. And I would say that part of that reflects a societal conversation about China, right? So there's this general narrative, certainly in the popular media, that always paints the CCP as inherently unstable. And there's a certain collapsism that exists in our own political discourse about China, sort of assuming that this is a system that's doomed to fail at some point. And in political science, most political scientists I know who are China scholars would argue against that point of view. And we draw heavily on this piece, which you referenced, which is by Andrew Nathan about authoritarian resilience. And it just points out to the many, many features of the CCP that have allowed it to last this long. And so I tend to think of that piece and that concept as sort of a jumping off point for us to think about some of the features of the CCP as a regime. And it is unusual. I think that's part of the reason why we write about this, is most authoritarian regimes live sort of brutish, short, violent existences. And this is a very successful party, a very successful regime. And so I think that's the reason why we get into it that way. But I think in the end, what we're seeing is people are delving into different aspects of the Chinese political system and just trying to understand them as they operate, right? So you have Manfred working on labor and someone like Molly working on censorship and Maria working on media and other things. And so, and that's consistent with the long tradition of Chinese politics of just trying to understand these institutions and aspects of society as well as we can. I think there is a tendency to assume a lot of these practices or sort of nature of political participation in China is indicative of frailty and collapse in the system, right? So you think about protests and so forth. A lot of people see protest figures in China and they assume that this indicates that people hate the government and it's on the verge of collapse. And so I think a lot of people are arguing against that type of simplistic logic.
Yeah, no, I think you're completely right on that, that there is this narrative, you know, in sort of public discussion about China, this kind of expectation that's been kind of confounded. So there's a little bit of residue of that. I think maybe for a lot of people, and you guys are probably a little too young for this to have been the kind of motive force in this, but still, you know, there's a lot of overhang from the fact that the end of the Cold War came right on the heels of the suppression of the Tiananmen protests. And, you know, so you saw the USSR dissolve, you saw communist rule end throughout the Warsaw Pact, but somehow it didn't in China. And so therein lies the mystery, right? I mean, so I think a lot of people were still sort of thinking about that in the background, maybe subliminally. But yeah, you're right. Years ago, I was chatting with this friend of mine, this guy named Matt Stinson, who's an American who's been living in Tianjin for a very long time, 20 years or so. He observed that, you know, America's great question about China always seems to boil down to, why don't you people hate your government as much as I think you should?
Which I think is— yeah, no, and there's, and certainly, and I think we'll talk about this more in our discussion today. When you present information like data that we have from public opinion in China that suggests that Chinese people not only don't hate their government, but actually like their government, support the political system, you sort of run into that line of thinking of people say, oh, that must not be true. Of course, they must dislike it or something like that. So I think there's, frankly, a little bit of wishful thinking as people impute their own ways of thinking or their own desires onto the Chinese political system. The one thing I wanted to add to our brief discussion of resilience is I think a lot of the reason why people are writing about this topic again is because a lot of the features of the Chinese political system that people were identifying, Andrew Nathan in particular, were identifying in the 2000s, those seem to be eroding, yeah. right? And so to fit your narrative, right? So the 1990s were about people expecting the party to fall. It didn't fall in 1989, but it sure looked brittle.
Yeah.
And then the 2000s roll around, they had a successful leadership transition and people started to write about how the party was institutionalized, but it also had village elections and all these other things going on that suggested that people had some mechanisms to voice their preferences, right?
Right.
And so now a lot of those practices, and certainly like leadership, succession, institutionalization, those seem to be eroding under Xi Jinping, certainly civil society as well. And so then the question is, well, there's sort of articles written about authoritarian resilience 2.0, or like, what is the party losing its resilience? Is it more fragile than it used to be? And so there's a renewed conversation because, of course, the China we see in 2022 is quite different than the China Andrew Nathan was writing about in 2002. And I think that's part of the scholarly narrative.
Oh, no, for sure. And yeah, I mean, they don't just seem to be eroding. They are eroding, right? Anyway, you alluded to the fact that there's always that skepticism that you're greeted with when you do any kind of social science research in China that relies on surveys, questionnaires, right? There's a lot of methodology in your paper, as I alluded to, but I think you're really good at putting that in layman's terms. But let's go right to that question that you raised, that one unavoidable methodological issue that always comes up anytime you talk about regime support in China, or what appears to be regime support. There's always been people that say that you can't get honest responses in a media controlled environment like China. There's always this kind of implicit assumption on the part of a lot of people that if you give the wrong answer on a survey, you hear a knock at your door at 3 a.m. So yeah. There's this claim of preference falsification, to use the term of art,
the jargony term. Yeah, let me just sort of outline a little bit about what that concept is and why it's an issue we all have to grapple with in survey research in China. So the basic concern is that in authoritarian systems, people are nervous about voicing their true opinions.
Right.
And there's the idea of preference falsification is that people will say one thing in public and feel another thing in private. And certainly that behavior exists as a phenomenon, not just in social science, in authoritarian settings. It exists at Thanksgiving dinner when you don't really feel like really talking about politics or whatever it is. So people do these sort of subtle lies all the
right.
time. But the question is when we do a survey and we see that people in an authoritarian system voice support for their government, should we believe that, or should we chalk that up to they're scared, or is it something in between? And that's a question that's actually motivated a lot of my recent work, is to try to unpack that a little bit. And I think probably most of your listeners are aware of this, but I would just say it one more time in case some folks aren't, is that the most robust finding we have about public opinion in China is that Chinese citizens voice extremely high levels of support for their government. That is, every single survey I've ever looked at going back decades now has that feature to it. And in fact, Chinese citizens voice higher levels of support for their government than any other people in the world, other than, I believe, Vietnam.
Hmm.
So then the question is that real? Is it something else? There's some people that believe that when Chinese citizens take surveys, they don't view it as an opportunity to express their own opinion. They view it as a test and are trying to say the so-called correct answer.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think we should be naive and just assume that problem away and say, oh, of course, we can trust these responses at face value. But we also shouldn't be paralyzed by that. And I think we can try to get to the bottom of it empirically. So one thing that I've been working on, and there's also a really good paper I'd recommend by Carrie Radigan and Leah Rabin in the China Quarterly. It's called Reevaluating Political Trust. We're trying to understand just how Chinese citizens take surveys. And one thing you can look at is, when do they say don't know? So typically when you ask someone a question like, how satisfied are you with the central government, something like that, you give people the option of saying nothing at
right.
all. And that's sort of a proxy for a couple different things. Like, that can be a proxy for political knowledge, right? So sometimes people say don't know because they don't really have a well-formed opinion. But sometimes they say don't know because they might be a little bit nervous.
Right.
And so typically what we observe in China is that Chinese citizens on sort of direct political questions do say don't know at higher rates than people elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's worth noting. But it's not that high. It tends to be about between 5 and 8% of people will do that.
Consistently across a bunch of questions that are related to political.
Yeah, across a bunch of questions. But an important feature of this is that it varies across different types of people. So that behavior is particularly high in rural areas. It's particularly high among older citizens and generally citizens who might be more politically marginalized, women, ethnic minorities, people from rural areas, and so forth. So one interpretation of that is those types of people might feel a little bit more nervous about expressing their political opinions, and sort of rightfully so, right? So like a lot of these surveys, especially the ones done face-to-face, like someone shows up at your door, knocks on your door in your village and asks you to voice your political opinions for sometimes 30, 40 minutes, an hour. So you would understand why sort of an elderly rural person might feel reluctant to just say their opinions based on what they've lived through. So that, I think that's an important caveat when we have our discussion today, is there is a little bit of evidence that some of these questions are sensitive. The flip side is when you look at other types of citizens, like young, urban, highly educated citizens, especially people taking surveys online, which is how a lot of surveys are done now, their don't know rates are very low. So comparable with what we would see in a democratic system. So I tend to take that as evidence that of that kind of Balingho, Jolingho type generation, they're just more willing to say how they feel. And so I'm more comfortable making conclusions about that type of population.
And typically, what do you do when you have a body of people who you can sort of identify as self-censorer types, you know, who will have a lot of these answers? Do you throw them out? A lot of people who decline to respond? Or,
yeah, there's no easy answer. You know, there's different approaches. So some people try to correct for that, right? And they try to say, like Radigan and Rubin, that paper, Rabin, the paper I mentioned, you know, they try to put boundaries on the level of support for the central government and say, okay, let's assume all those people actually hate the government. What would the number look like now? Let's assume they love the government. What would the number look like now? So you can, that's called imputation. That's one technique. You can discard them. In the paper that we're going to talk about today, one approach I use is to just analyze the people who say they dislike the government. So you can kind of flip the question on its head and say, well, look, there are a subset of people on these surveys that really are willing to say they dislike the Chinese government and dislike the regime. So we know those people aren't self-censoring.
Right.
So let's understand them. And then that sort of mitigates the issue. To some extent.
It sure does. And so, yeah, with that out of the way, let's dive in now and talk about the actual research and your findings. So let's talk about, first of all, these data sets that you did work with. There were three surveys. Is that correct?
Yeah. So surveys in China are alive and well. A lot of people would be surprised to know the kind of the extent of survey research in China. It's been ongoing since the 1980s. And it's a little bit complex from a regulatory perspective, and there's different types of surveys, right? So there's face-to-face surveys, which tend to be more expensive and rely a lot on local implementation, and you need a local partner to usually execute those for you. Then there's online surveys, which can be done in a number of different ways, sometimes through marketing companies. And then there's standard sort of in-class surveys. There's a lot of different approaches. So in this paper, I try to do the same thing three times. I have one survey that's an online survey, one survey that's a nationally representative urban survey, face-to-face, and then another survey was conducted in classrooms in Beijing universities. And the hope is that no sample of China, it's hard to get a good sample of China. It's really difficult. But if the same answer emerges in three different approaches, then we feel more confident in it. So that's why I did it that way.
And in fact, that does seem to be the case, right? The same sorts of profiles emerge in all three of these.
Yeah, the results were pretty darn consistent. And I actually was surprised that the student sample, so there is a sample which is not Beijing University, across several universities in Beijing, but sort of university age respondents, the same configuration of attitudes and personality traits emerged in that group. And that was a little surprising to me, because you might think that the position of the party in their social world is different than in the rest of China. The younger citizens might be more critical or something like that. But in fact, I found a pretty darn consistent finding. So that's something we can talk about more.
Yeah, so let's not spoil anything just yet, and we'll do the drum roll when there's an appropriate time where you can do the big reveal. But first, let's talk a little bit about some of the terminology that's important to understand here. You use what's called a Hexaco model of personality structure. Can you explain how that works? Hexaco is an acronym for 6 different dyads, I guess. Can you walk us through Hexaco really quickly?
Yeah. So personality researchers, and personality research is a huge, huge field in and of itself in psychology. And a long tradition of trying to measure people's traits. And that there is a general consensus that personality is real. People have certain traits that reliably predict their behavior across a range of different situations. So if I'm extroverted in one setting, I tend to be extroverted in another mm-hmm. setting. It's not always the case, but we do have personalities. I think that's sort of pretty obvious.
Some of us.
I've got none left after this last year. But so that's one thing. And then other features of this that I think are important to emphasize are this idea that personality is in part genetically determined. And in fact, it manifests itself early in the life cycle. Right. So there's studies that show that like personality at age 3 is correlated with personality at age 27, which is worrisome to me because I have a very challenging 4-year-old, and I'm like, he's going to be challenging his whole life. Are you kidding? But so personality is one part genetics, but it is also the nurture and environment component is there as well. Right. And then in terms of Hexaco and how that works, is some of the big debates in the personality field, as I understand, are about like, well, what exactly are the traits and how we can measure them? And there's debate here, and there are some people that think there are 5 traits. That's the so-called 5-factor model, the big 5. Mm-hmm. And then the model I use is a 6-factor model, which is just says that there are, in general, 6 stable traits that we can measure across individuals and, importantly, across cultures and countries and contexts. And so that's why I used this particular framework, because it's actually been replicated in many countries across the world and including China. So I felt pretty good about the data. In terms of what the traits are, Hexaco stands for, if I botch this, it's going to completely undermine my credibility. Honesty, humility. Honesty, humility is the H. It's the extent to which you're honest and humble and kind of sincere in your dealings. Emotionality is the E. Emotionality is sort of how much do you feel emotion. It's also captures things like anxiety and fearfulness. Mm-hmm. X is extroversion versus introversion. Mm-hmm. A is agreeableness, which is the extent to which you're sort of seek agreement and harmony in your interactions with other people. Conversely, are you willing to get into it with other people, have an argument? Are you kind of more curmudgeonly, cantankerous? C is conscientiousness, which is the extent to which you seek organization in your life. Are you well-organized, disciplined, diligent, hardworking? And then O is a big one for our purposes today. It's called openness to experience. And that tends to capture things like creativity, aesthetic appreciation, artistic nature, intellectualism. So are you open to new ideas? Are you trying new things? And so those are the traits. And in the paper, I have just really good data on personality traits across the 3 surveys. And so I just ran a full battery of these personality tests across a lot of Chinese citizens. And I was able to then relate those to political attitudes and try to understand what types of people like the Chinese government, like the party, what types of people don't like the party, and even different groups, sort of CCP members versus not CCP members. How do they vary in terms of these different traits?
Okay, so what did you expect you might find going into this, and in what ways were you surprised? Let me ask about what your own expectations are, and also sort of what we would expect from what we know about the relationship between personality type and attitude toward the state, toward governments in democratic societies.
Yeah, so I think my hypothesis was perhaps a little bit unimaginative and was driven by perhaps my own biases as a Westerner, but also reading this body of research, in that I expected to see what we might call like the enlightened discontent model. Right. Which is that, how do you become discontent with the Chinese political system? Well, you expose yourself to counter-regime information, you're leaping the Great Firewall, you're studying abroad, whatever you're doing, you're being exposed to information that's counter to the regime's narrative. And you're, for that reason, we would expect people with this O trait, exactly, high openness to experience, to that would be predictive of political discontent in China. And the reason why that had some backing prior to my own study is that in other contexts, we've seen that openness to experience is highly correlated with sort of progressive and liberal attitudes in Western democracies, for example. So it tends to be people with that trait that gravitate towards the liberal end of the political spectrum. Of course, we know that the liberal end of the American political spectrum isn't the same as the liberal end of the Chinese political spectrum. No, but in general, you could sit in Princeton or Philadelphia, wherever I was sitting at the time, and tell yourself that, okay, it's those sort of artistic, intellectual types that are going to be most critical of the government, and that trait should pop. So that was sort of the overarching hypothesis going in.
Sure. And now the final drum roll.
Well, yeah, the reveal. is as dramatic as an academic finding can be. The answer we found is that really openness to experience is not systematically related to political discontent. And by discontent, if people ask me, like, how do you measure this? And there's different ways to go about it. But there's a very common question format in China surveys, which is, how satisfied are you with the central government, right, on a scale of 0 to 10? I think 95% of people will give the government a 6 or above, which is telling. But you have about 5 to 8% of Chinese citizens that on a survey are willing to say they are unhappy with the government. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what they're unhappy about. It doesn't necessarily mean they want democracy. But that was sort of a relatively straightforward and, I think, transparent way of identifying discontent. And so then the question is, what do those people look like from a personality perspective? And the simple answer is the sort of enlightened discontent model doesn't appear to be correct, at least in average. Those sorts of citizens do not have high levels of openness to experience. In fact, they might have slightly lower levels of openness to experience. And the big traits that pop are things like extroversion and agreeableness, and to some extent, fearfulness and anxiety.
Or they're very, very low on the extroversion.
Low on those traits. Right. So another way of just summarizing it would be to say it's really more of like an isolated discontent. So China's discontented citizens, on average, tend to be highly introverted. They tend to be removed from other people. They tend to have a more disagreeable personalities, willing to get in arguments with people, have less harmony in their social relationships. And they're also, interestingly, more fearful, more anxious people, and less emotionally dependent on others. So they tend to be kind of lone wolf types. And I would emphasize it's important to say tend to be, because this is all about averages. And certainly there are many Chinese citizens, we all know many of them, that fit different models of discontent. And not everybody who's discontent with China has this set of personality traits. So I would emphasize that. But on average, that seems to be a finding, is that isolation, social isolation, and as it manifests itself in personality, is related to political discontent in China today.
Well, obviously, the question that I think everyone would immediately go to is, what's the causal direction here? I mean, frustratingly, of course, with this sort of thing, we can never really know for sure. Are these people politically discontented because of their personalities, or have their personalities been, you know, malformed by political forces, by political repression? You make the suggestion that there's a kind of feedback loop operating here. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and I think the answer is that the causation probably goes in both directions,
right.
And that's not always satisfying to people, and it's also something that's very difficult to tease out in any study, because personality doesn't really change that much over time. It's hard to measure that. So all I can say is, look, there's an association here, and then I have to do a little bit more speculation as to why. But the way I think about it is sort of those isolating traits that I identified, introversion, low levels of agreeableness, things like that. In personality studies, there's pretty good evidence that those types of traits tend to be associated with social isolation and a lack of personal and professional success.
Right.
So you see everything from lower job performance, alcoholism, suicide, depression, those sorts of things. It's certainly not determinative, but people with those personality traits tend to have a little bit of a harder time fitting into society. And If you have that, then perhaps you're a little bit disgruntled with your position in society, and that leads you to have a little bit less satisfaction with the political system. So you can kind of imagine a pretty clear line of thinking that goes from being having that set of traits to coming to the conclusion that there's something bad about the Chinese government. Now, then the other side of the story, which I think you importantly raised, is, well, now let's say I'm in kind of that dissident or discontent part of the Chinese political space. Maybe I'm participating in a little bit of activism. Maybe I'm having some more subversive conversations. Maybe I'm posting things online that the Chinese government doesn't like. Once you start experiencing that repression, if that the Chinese repressive apparatus kicks in, you can imagine that that would then lead to an exacerbation of these traits, right? So certainly fearfulness, which I identified, and anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
Once you start getting repressed, you probably feel those traits more strongly. Also, introversion, I think, is an important one. Like I've been fortunate to have a lot of conversations with people in the activist community in China over the years. And many of them will cite the fact that, like, once they became targeted by the state, they became poisonous, right? Like people don't want to be around them. They also don't want to bring harm to their friends and family. And so they tend to become socially isolated once they become marked by the state. So the answer is, I think it does flow in both directions. And that's why there's a feedback loop, which is these traits sort of create a cycle. And in the end, the net result is you have a set of people who are socially isolated and have those personality traits. And the most critical citizens are probably in that space.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess we should probably make clear that the types of individuals that you're focused on here in this paper are not the kind of dissidents to whom or with whom, you know, many of us are familiar. They're not the prominent regime critics, even though some of them might have told you that they had that sort of passive experience of becoming socially isolated. That's not what we're talking about here, right? We're not.
No, that's thank you for saying that. Yeah. So I've been fortunate to get to know that community. A lot of them are based in the part of the country that I'm in. And those individuals have a very different personality profile. They have a lot more traits associated with leadership, like extroversion in particular, and social confidence and things like that. So what I'm talking about are people who are sitting in China, wherever they are, voicing discontent with the Chinese government on a survey.
Right.
And that's very different than leading a social movement or engaging in protests and so forth. And you can look at that in the data as well, right? So I actually have, in my surveys, I collected political participation variables and things like petitioning, protesting, mm-hmm. that sort of activity. And you see that those types of people actually have a very different personality profile as well. They tend to be a lot more confident. They're a lot more...
less fear, for sure.
Yeah, less fear. It's a different type of person, which I think is also interesting and speaks to this idea that people engaging in protest in China today aren't necessarily the most discontented with the system itself or with the government itself. And Lily Tsai and Kevin O'Brien and many others have pointed to this idea that a lot of contentious activity in China might actually be regime reinforcing, right? There, people are trying to voice their preferences to higher levels of government. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're deeply dissatisfied right. with the central government in particular. So these are different groups of people. But I think it's, yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. And I got nervous as I wrote this study because my nightmare is that somebody says, oh, you know, professor says that Chinese citizens who are discontent with the government have a certain personality type. And this personality type isn't bad. It's that there's no one right personality. And so there's different traits and I can identify those traits, but I'm not speaking out any particular individual. And I'm glad you helped me make that caveat because I think it's really important.
Yeah, there's another passage in your paper, which I thought was really important, was I can't quote it chapter and verse right now, but you talked about the barriers that one has to get over in order to express discontent in the first place. I mean, that there's a lot of social pressure, that it's not just coming from on high. It's not just the propaganda. It's not just the other barriers that are placed in your path, but it's a lot of it is from the family, from your peers, from school, from your whole process of socialization. So yeah, I think that's important to point out as well. Now, we've talked about what these disgruntled people might look like sort of, you know, in aggregate. What about the other side of it? What does a party member's personality structure tend to look like? Because you've included that in your study, and I thought it was really fascinating. Quite a contrast.
Yeah, and unfortunately, in the process of publishing this paper, I had a pretty catchy, pithy title called Personality of the Party, which I thought was nice. And that was nixed in the review process, and it became the sweeping political discontent in China is associated with isolating personality traits, which is less catchy. But I do look at the personalities of CCP members as they compare to non-CCP members. And you tend to see that CCP members have personalities that are, for lack of a better phrasing, associated with personal and professional success. So they tend to be highly agreeable. Mm-hmm. They get along well with other people. This personality trait's also associated with kind of social conformity, political conformity, which makes sense. They tend to be less neurotic, mm-hmm. less fearful, less anxious, which again is what we might expect. And importantly, they tend to have traits associated with leadership. So highly extroverted, a lot of social confidence, like being around other people, and so forth. And so I joke, and this is, again, this is a joke, but they tend to have a personality profile that's not dissimilar from what I would observe among like an average Princeton student, which is where I work. And I say that with fondness for my students, and that, you know, these are really dynamic people, and a lot of young dynamic people in China are gravitating towards the party, which is not news to anybody who's following what's going on and understands anything about recruitment into the party. But it's really interesting to see it manifest itself in the data that way.
Yeah, I think that there's a very similar pattern going on with the whole college application process, right? The regime's power rests in part on its ability to, you know, to determine what psychological attributes are going to get rewarded and which ones don't, right? Or are even punished, right? So there's some kind of reinforcement going on here. The kids who are in grade school who are conscientious and are gregarious and upbeat and helpful, and they, you know, apply themselves and, you know, they're open, they're the ones who get, you know, the red neckerchief, right? That they mm-hmm. become the young pioneers. They're the banjang or whatever, and then mm-hmm. then, you know, they move on to the Communist Youth League and then into party membership, right? So these same traits, you know, the very traits that they possess are then the basis for picking the next crop. It's sort of like, you know, if we're going to talk about university students, it's sort of like the Greek system, you know, when I was in college, right? Of course, they're all going to end up being basically the same. They're picking people who are like them.
And importantly, you know, the traits, I'd have to look back at the data. I actually do think, I'd have to look back at it, but I believe party members also have relatively high levels of openness to experience. They're not robots, brainwashed automatons. You know, they're creative people that are trying to contribute to Chinese society in different ways. And the path to success in China lies through the party, lies through the government. So it's not that surprising, but I think it speaks a little bit to the question we talked about at the beginning of the podcast about stability. And it's hard to imagine. I wish I could do this study in sort of 1988, yeah. Right? And you wonder if the same configuration of traits was present then. And was it the case? I mean, I won't go as far as to say that the party is cool today. I think that's a leap from the data, but there's little in my data that suggests that, you know, people who are kind of more socially adept, so have a lot of social capital in Chinese universities are moving away from the party. But what I was going to end say is that if you have this configuration of political attitudes and social dynamics, you can see why kind of a large scale political protest aimed at destabilizing the regime would have trouble getting off the ground, right?
Yeah, so
if the discontent lie on the social periphery and by nature of their personalities have trouble interacting with other people, getting along well with other people, you can see why there's a certain stability baked into the social structure of China today. And I was interested to see that play out in the data.
So I'm wondering, did you have a kind of intuition about the difference between the types of individuals with a propensity toward, you know, political dissent in a democracy versus an authoritarian regime. I mean, because it's funny to me when I think about this. This is something that my wife and I talked about really quite early on when we first started to notice that so many kind of regime critics in the Chinese context who were in the United States or were like interested in American politics in some way were gravitating toward Trump. They tended to be Trump supporters. Now, I ended up actually doing a show on this. I don't know if you heard it, but with Lin Yao.
And it's like a concept of like beaconism.
Exactly.
I think there's a paper in Journal of Contemporary China.
That's the one. Yeah, so yeah, we talked about that beaconism. Ian Johnson was on that show as well. My wife, though, said that we were ignoring in that whole conversation the obvious thing to her, which was that she said that it just was all about personality. Her sense was that people who are, you know, political malcontents in China share a lot of traits, she said, with people in the United States, Chinese people I'm talking about, who are interested in Trump. I wasn't really quite sure what she was getting at, but I after, you know, talking to her for a while, I think she's kind of onto something. You know, for her, there were a couple of types. There was the one that was a little too conscientious and a little too much of a busybody. The one who had to, you know, like the dazibao writing type, or the person who was like the, you know, the person shouting, "造反有理, 革命无罪." But I still, I mean, for her, it wasn't like the same exact batch of isolating traits, but it was things like suspicion. Right, a low level of trust, and that general cantankerousness. And I have to say, I think she was onto something there. But
yeah, no, and I want to tread lightly here because I don't want to draw false equivalencies. I do think there's a set of traits, and I think your wife's point about trust is particularly important, right? So you mentioned the cognitive process one has to go through
to come to the conclusion
that the Chinese government is wrong and they're lying to you. Your teachers have been lying to you. Many people around you have been brainwashed, or that kind of that thought process is not easy to get to, and requires you to accept a certain level of dissonance in your life. And it's much easier to go along with the system, believe the narrative that the party represents the nation and it's going to bring about the rejuvenation of the, it's sort of an easier cognitive sell. And there's arguments in psychology called system justification theory is a big one. And it's, the basic idea is that people tend to
take the blue pill.
Yeah. Well, they tend to go along with the system they're in and justify it and understand it. So then you talked about discontent elsewhere and I think there's a certain personality type in the United States that's also just generally of the belief that we're being fed a bunch of lies by people in powerful corporations and the government and so forth. And that sort of disagreeable cantankerousness, distrust, conspiracy theory mindset is true. And on all sides of the political spectrum, probably more true on the American right today. Yeah. But relatedly, like there's different types. And I think your wife's point about different types, I think, matters, right? So there's a difference between that person who's, you know, commenting on Kaiser's Twitter posts and the person who's out in the street or the person who's part of an organization. Like there's different types, right? And so I think there's the set of people that maybe I'm identifying are the people that are more isolated, not as actually politically active, but distrustful. And there's a pocket of those people that perhaps can be mobilized by more entrepreneurial types, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Speaking of, you know, in different political settings, right, toward the end of the piece, you draw some comparisons between these results for China and the results of, I suppose, similar work looking at Putin's Russia. Can you talk about what you found and what you believe might account for some of these differences?
Yeah, so there's a really good study called Agreeable Authoritarians by Sam Green and Graham Robertson, who do a very similar exercise in Russia. And the findings are quite similar. And they find that support for Putin or willingness to vote for Putin, I would believe was their outcome, is highly related to agreeableness. That's the kind of key feature that they identify. And then people who are conscientious, which is again, sort of seeking organization in your life, kind of diligent, like that type of person, that trait tends to be associated with political conservatism in a lot of places. Sure. They find that is related to support for Putin. So it's a similar set of findings. The key difference I find in China is that extroversion, sort of social isolation, really, really, really matter even more.
Right.
And so the way I think about it is that perhaps it's the case in authoritarian systems that this configuration of personality traits that I identify and that Green and Robertson identify as well, maybe that's consistent across a lot of different regimes. And the key difference in my mind, I'm not a Russia specialist, but a key difference in the two political systems is the degree of political competition and political participation, the nature of political participation. In Russia, in contrast to China, there are elections, there are national elections. Putin has to go through an electoral process. There are opposition parties in the Duma and so forth. And so there's a little bit more of a social structure and political structure in place for people who are more oppositional thinkers.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's the reason why they're not quite as isolated. They're not quite as removed from the social network as we see in China.
Yeah, another key difference.
But that's a guess. Yeah. That's a conjecture.
My guess would be, I mean, in addition to what you said about somewhat competitive nature of politics in Russia, is that in Russia, the party, the ruling party, is only a thin layer. It doesn't permeate the state. The party isn't almost coterminous or congruent with the state.
Yeah, the congruence between the party and the government, right? And also the patronage network, right? So the nomenklatura system in China and just the fact that, 100 million jobs or something like that are controlled by the party.
Exactly.
I think that's a regime capacity story as well would matter.
Yeah, for sure. So over the last couple of years, I don't know how many times I have, been in these debates or watched these debates, unfurl over if culture, however that's defined in any given discussion, if culture is like a valuable explanatory variable in different COVID responses, like, not just by state actors, but also by the governed, or in the case of the U.S., by the ungovernable. It's just not a big surprise that there's, a ton of resistance from your discipline within, political science to any explanations that invoke culture. And I totally get that. Nobody wants to be that, that essentialist, right? But when we start seeing patterns in character traits that correspond to political attitudes in one country, and these patterns look different from the set of character traits that you'd see corresponding to, similar political attitudes in another country, are we that far away from saying, hey, there's a difference in political culture going on here, and it's important? I mean,
yeah, I think, of course, there's a difference in political culture between China and the U.S. And I think, of course, that's manifesting itself in the COVID response and how individual citizens across the two places are viewing their obligation to each other and viewing information coming out of the government. I don't think Chinese citizens. Also, I think both people in both places are also a little bit distrusting of official narratives about COVID because they've been so politicized in both places for different reasons. But yeah, culture is always thorny in political science, and I would say it hasn't always been that way. So a lot of the classics we read, like Allman and Verba and others, talk about political culture and try to identify different political cultures and sort of the ones you hear are like an individualistic political culture,
right,
participatory political culture, or like a subject political culture where someone views themselves as being ruled. We tend to avoid those because, yeah, they're a little bit essentialist. And also just, I don't think they capture a lot of the nuance as to what's going on. But the one thing I would say on this point is a key difference for me that keeps coming out, and I've been doing some work looking at political education materials in China, and I think it's important to note that political culture is just sort of a shared set of attitudes. That's generally how it's defined, a shared set of attitudes about the political system,
right,
and how it works and what it's all about. And in the U.S., you could say, what are our shared beliefs? Well, it's that we live in a democracy is important, individual votes and political participation is important. also freedom matters, right? So the role of the government is to protect people's freedoms and shouldn't interfere too much in people's lives. Like that's a part of our political culture. But a key feature of political culture is that it requires socialization. It's passed down from generation to generation. And in places like China, the government plays the major role in setting culture. And so, and we've seen a renewed emphasis on that under Xi Jinping. So lately I've been looking at political education textbooks at different levels. And what's very striking to me is this sort of subservience of the individual's goals to that of the nation. Yeah. And that's not news to you or your listeners, but you know, I remember being in Beijing when I was doing field work and you would see these billboards at the beginning of like the China Dream era, like 中国梦,我的梦. Like they would just say those two phrases and they'd show somebody playing chess or something like this. And I just thought that captured it neatly, which is like sort of my dream is the equivalent of the Chinese nation. And so I think that's part of why what we see the difference in the COVID response is I think there's a little bit more emphasis on individual responsibility to public health in China than there is here.
I didn't mean to talk specifically about the COVID response. Just that. This is one of those things that brought culture back into the conversation again. I'm curious what you understand the difference between political psychology and political culture to be.
Yeah, this is that. That's a good question, and it feels like a comprehensive exam question that I would probably be bombing. But you know, political culture is a shared set of beliefs and attitudes, and that give order to this system, help people understand their political system. And shared doesn't mean uniform, but it does mean sort of a widely held set of ideas. And I would say kind of the political psychology, the constellation of traits and attitudes that we observe is a reflection of the political culture, right? So you grow up in a political culture and the ideas you gravitate towards, the leaders you gravitate towards are a function of the culture you're in and the traits that you possess.
Right.
And so I would say that's the direction, that's how it flows, but they're certainly entangled with each other.
I would pass you on that.
I felt like a
B plus
pass answer. Like let them go on to the next stage of the program. Not distinction, but we'll
ask you the harder one. So is China authoritarian because of the political psychology of its people, or do they have that particular political psychology because China has its particular authoritarian political system?
No. brutal.
I'm actually joking here because that's not knowable. Rory, what would be the next question though to explore for anyone who's interested in doing further work on this set of topics? What do you feel like you came into this with where you feel like the data is there but you didn't yet decide to tackle the question? What's the next one?
Yeah, I'm increasingly thinking about psychology of authoritarian rule. And so taking this question of why people support the government seriously, and this is not a new question in our field, right? There's been a lot of work by Bruce Dixon and Tang Wenfang and Melanie Manning and Pierre Landry and many, many other people on kind of public opinion questions in China. And So trying to bring in some of these ideas from psychology into our field and understanding a little bit more about how people process information, I think that's an area for growth. Another trap that I fall into quite a bit, and certainly in this paper, is, you know, there's a tendency to say the Chinese people say this, or a tendency to treat Chinese citizens as a monolith.
You were pretty good on that count.
No, I'm not as good as I should be. And I think there's a lot of different configurations of attitudes and beliefs and personalities and forms of political participation that we don't really understand. And I think there's a lot of work that can be done on that, like understanding the new left or understanding, you know, all these different political movements, especially among younger people. I think that would be fruitful. So I feel like we're just, there's actually a lot of public opinion data in China. A lot of the interview-based work that's been done, some of it by journalists, like people like Eric Fish, you know, that's really compelling work as well. And so I think that would be another area for growth
for sure.
in this space. Yeah.
By the way, I mean, I just have to commend you on your list of references in this one paper. It's as long as the damn paper. I mean, it's like a pretty comprehensive bibliography of work that's been done on psychology in authoritarian states. It's amazing. It's actually
well, and you can if your listeners just want to look at the references, that's a completely fine. They don't have to read the paper, but they just want the reading list. That's more than
one. The reading list is really good. No, I mean, you know, you read a paper like you read a paper these days. You skip the math in the middle. You just read the, you know,
that's
the
fine.
Diagonal yeah. reading style. I mean, I think we all know how to do that now. And we just assume that you guys know what you're doing when it comes to, you know, regression analyses and all that stuff. So, no, it was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. Those of us who are interested in reading about the nexus of psychology and politics could do worse, definitely, than looking at your references. Rory, you are somebody who likes to bring in approaches and ideas from other disciplines. Can you talk about some of the other work that's done that kind of inter or cross-disciplinary thing?
Yeah, I mean, the China field is, I think, at a really exciting place in that it's growing so fast. Yeah. And I've been fortunate I was on our PhD admissions committee this year, and the level of talent coming into social science PhD programs is wild. And a lot of it is coming from China, and people are coming in with a lot of training and a lot of different lenses through which to look at the world. So I've had PhD students that are coming in with computer science undergraduate training or math undergraduate training wow. or other types of training, literature, other things. And so I think I've always just been a believer in kind of cross-pollination across fields and how that can produce new insight. And the people that I admire deeply on this front, you know, someone like Molly Roberts, who we're all a fan of. Molly was one of the first people to kind of do big data goes to China. And because of her unique training, her master's in stats and other things, like she led the way for a lot of us. And we're all trying desperately to catch up and unable to ever do so, but we can just try to lead, to follow her wherever she takes us. But, you know, so that's one tradition that's alive and well. But I also think like there's some really good qualitative researchers out there right now who are having a tougher time because it's harder to get access to China, who are approaching things from like a more anthropological approach. Yiza Ding is one that comes to mind, has done really good ethnography on the Chinese environmental bureaucracy. Maria Repnikova, who you mentioned. So I think, yeah, like there's just so much. The China field is becoming a very, very big tent with a lot of people doing a lot of different things. And I think we're learning more. And I'm very optimistic about the direction of the field moving forward. The one catch is, there's just not that many opportunities, and the position of China studies in the United States is just wildly lags behind where it should be. You know, most universities have one or two China specialists in the social sciences, if that, and we'll have, you know, 15 people studying the American political system or something like that. And so I my hope is that, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, there's more of an investment in China studies because there's so much talent coming in and not enough opportunity to meet that talent.
As long as they're not all hijacked by the national security apparatus. I mean, just seems to be have a boundless appetite for them. It's just a
well, and that's not. And I think you're making a joke, but I also don't think it's a bad thing to have like a deep, you know, deep China specialist entering into the U.S. government. And historically, there's been an issue where the closer one is to China, the better one's language ability. It seems to be a net negative when trying to get into the U.S. government.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Feeding the kind of PhD population into the U.S. government or other governments around the world wouldn't be a bad thing either.
That's what I want. Yeah. I mean, Anyway, fantastic. Rory, it's been such a pleasure to talk about this paper with you. And congratulations on not just getting bogged down in the weeds of you know, methodology and all that. So
I did all right. Great. All right. That's good.
That was fantastic. Cool. Let's move on to recommendations. But first, a very quick reminder that if you enjoy the work that we do with the Seneca podcast, the best way you can support us is by subscribing to SUP China Access, our daily email newsletter. It is just chock full of, you know, great tidbits and things from all over hundreds of different news sources. And it's, you know, hand curated by our own Jeremy Goldcorn and his crack team. So that's what you do to support us, and I thank you in advance. Let's move on properly now to recommendations. Rory, what do you have for us?
Okay, so I have two. I have one more serious and one more lighthearted.
Right.
The first is an organization which I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of, but in case they haven't, there's a think tank, kind of an academic think tank called Center for Security and Emerging Technology, CSET, is out of Georgetown. And I was on their website the other day. They have roughly 50 people working there now, and it's just a new think tank that's just doing a lot of really good data-driven work on technology. And a lot of their work does touch on China and informs things like immigration policy and the China initiative and all of that going on. So I have found them to just be a real voice of reason, and they're not particularly on one side of the political space when it comes to China, but they're just do really thorough work, and I admire what they're doing in their organization. So I'd encourage you to check that out.
In fact, they're not just not on one side. They are on all sides of it. It's really funny. I was reading, I do this China Stories podcast where I will, read aloud, long pieces. And there was one from The Wire that relied very, very heavily on CSET sources, but they were almost uniformly in opposition to one another. They never had the same opinion.
And you don't always see that in a think tank. And a lot of their staff are relatively young, and they're doing cool data-driven work, but they also do things like document translations and so forth. So if you're kind of on the younger end of the China watching community and looking for a place to go work, I think that would be a fantastic place to start your career. All right, and then the less serious one. People are like, what are you reading, right? What are you reading? Well, I'm getting through a pandemic with two kids under five, so I'm reading a lot of children's books, and I'm going to recommend some for the moms and dads out there. I'm sure you have a lot of time to be listening to podcasts right now, but there's two guys, Eric and Terry Fahn. They're the Fahn brothers. Uh-huh. They are Canadians, but I believe they have Chinese heritage. I think their father is Chinese. And just the most fantastic storytellers, really imaginative. Like I read a lot of children's books, and a lot of them are pretty dull. These guys are so creative. And there's two books called The Night Garner and one called The Barnabas Project that are our favorite children's books.
Oh,
and
great.
So I'd recommend those to anybody looking to mix up their library.
Fantastic. Thanks. Great recommendations. I am actually making my way through some of the books that have been recommended by recent guests. So there's nothing new from me on the book front. In fact, the one that I just published, or I will have published today, we're recording on January 13th, with Anthea Roberts and Nicholas Lamp, is so full of book recommendations, either that we sort of mentioned in passing or that we actually recommend, that it's going to take me a while to get through. But the one thing that I have been doing, like so many other of my sort of low willpower friends on social media, is playing the game Wordle.
I feel like I have to do it just to understand the
phenomenon. It's a phenomenon, and I know that I'm just a cliche by talking about this even.
But am I going to lose like a day of my life?
No. That's the thing. That's the great thing about it, is they only give you one a day, and it's bounded. You'll Jones for doing more of them because it's pretty fun. It's Mastermind, but with words. It's sort of Hangman meets Mastermind. It's super, super simple. But it's fun. I mean, it's incredibly fun. And I don't know how I've ended up spending way more time actually discussing optimal strategies with different friends of mine. A couple of guys I knew at Baidu, one of them has decided to write like an algorithm that
I'm sure someone's out there has like coded this thing up.
Yeah, they have. I mean, there have been, clones, knockoffs, but also just sort of solving agents for it. But I actually have found myself this every night for the last week, staying up until midnight when the next puzzle drops.
That's not what I need right now. But I'm going to check.
Yeah, I mean, then by 12:10, I've tweeted my score. I should be ashamed of myself, and yet,
it's all right.
Yeah.
It's all right. Got to get through January.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Kaiser.
Yeah, Rory. Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced and edited by me, Kaiser Guo. We'd be delighted if you'd drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com, or just as good, give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, as this really does help people discover the show. Meanwhile, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChinaNews, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.